Well, let me first give you a little bit of my background in UFOs. I was a rather strange little kid. At 8 years of age, I started really getting into astronomy, so much so that it worried my parents and my teachers. And by the time I was 16, I found myself president of Vancouver's Amateur Astronomy Society. And because of my knowledge of the skies and the heavens, I was called upon to deal with a flood, a literal flood of UFO reports that our astronomy club was receiving at that time. And one thing I learned about UFOs right away is most of them are not UFOs. Probably half of them are the planet Venus. Most people have no idea how bright Venus can be when you see it in the early morning. You can read a newspaper by it. And I remember one case where a couple of policemen on motorcycles were chasing a UFO at about 110 miles an hour through Vancouver city streets. They were chasing Venus. Never caught up with Venus. But with that experience as a teenager and going on to college, University of British Columbia, I found that the astronomy department there, most astronomers don't watch the sky very well, and so they would call upon us who are amateurs again to handle these UFO reports that they're receiving. And then to support my education, I would work during the summer as a janitor for the Vancouver Sun. And they found out about my interest in astronomy. And of course, they were getting all kinds of phone calls about UFOs. And so they rather facetiously formed this flying saucer bureau. And one of the reporters would get calls in about a rash of sightings and UFOs, they would say, please hold the line and we'll transfer you to our UFO bureau, which was a janitor's office down in the... I wonder how many of those people knew they were talking to the janitor. And after receiving my undergraduate degree, I found myself at the University of Toronto. And there again, they were getting these rash of UFO reports and didn't know what to do with them. And they found it above my background, so I found myself handling those too. And that also continued when I was at Caltech. So altogether, I've been handling UFO reports for a little more than 12 years at three different institutions. I'd like to first define my terms. What are UFOs? Unidentified flying objects, popularly known as flying saucers. Things that we see in the sky that don't appear to have a proper or a natural explanation. Now, there are millions of sightings of what people think are UFOs and flying saucers, and statistically, about 95% of them turn out to be IFOs, identified flying objects. I mentioned Venus. Up in Vancouver, yeah, as popular as Venus were the Pleiades. Vancouver has a range of mountains, and when the Pleiades rise, they rise almost in a parallel fashion just above the mountains. So we were always getting these reports of these seven flying saucers coming up over the mountains and just sitting above the horizon for a few hours. And we would just ask them what the location was and then reassure them that this was the Pleiades and nothing to worry about. For instance, many birds will mate in phosphorescent mud, and then they fly at night, and you see these glowing birds in the sky. And we would note the mating seasons of various kinds of birds that like to nest in phosphorescent mud, and we'd just look at the dates of the sightings, and we could pretty well figure out what's happening. Now, from my own experience, I would say about 99% of UFOs are IFOs, probably because the people we had processing the UFO reports were more knowledgeable than your average investigator about the heavens, and so we could identify them a little more rapidly than others. We were also a little more knowledgeable about the various prank groups that were going on. University of British Columbia and University of Toronto had these undergraduate engineers who just loved to set up little UFO flats. They would get a bunch of hydrogen balloons and set them off and wait for them to explode. And sure enough, the next day in the newspapers would be abundance of these UFO reports. They were the same guys who were going around with plywood Bigfoots whenever it snowed. So I got to know them by their tactics. A lot of them were my own friends, so I knew what they were up to. But there is that 1%, or 5%, depending who's investigating these things. And recently, another astrophysicist, a fellow by the name of Dr. Hynek, has classified unidentified flying objects into three categories. If you've been watching the movies, you probably saw a movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And that was borrowed from Dr. Hynek. And he classified UFOs into three categories. There's a close encounter of the first kind, which is a sighting or detection of an unidentified flying object. And this is one that's passed through the test for Venus and the Pleiades and engineering stunts and so forth. Even so, we discover over the course of world history over 700,000 recorded cases of UFO sightings or close encounters of the first kind. Then we move into the close encounters of the second kind, and this is where evidence, or perhaps a better word would be damage, remaining from a UFO encounter. These would be these burnt grass and tree limbs being snapped off, this kind of thing. And there are over 800 recorded cases of close encounters of the second kind. Then the one with which the film was patterned after, close encounters of the third kind, is where there is actual contact with an occupant of a UFO, or what I will call for the rest of this talk, a UFO knot. As opposed to, say, an astronaut. And there are over 1,000 such cases, apparent cases, of actual contact with an occupant of a flying saucer or an unidentified flying object. I'm going to share with you, for the remainder of the time, 10 UFO maxims. And these maxims I borrowed from a friend of mine in Canada, another astrophysicist by the name of Peter Millman, and he put together these 10 maxims of UFOs. And he's not a Christian, but it's interesting to note his first maxim. He quotes from the book of Ecclesiastes and states that there is no new thing under the sun. And by stating that maxim, he's merely helping us to realize that as far as UFOs are concerned, the phenomenon has always been with us, and there have been encounters of the first, second, and third kind all the way back through human history. To give you some examples of UFOs throughout history, let me just share with you this list of famous UFO witnesses. It's not just the senile farmers out in the Midwest that are seeing these unidentified flying objects. Rather respectable people are seeing them as well. We used to refer to people who saw UFOs as psychoceramics, a classy word for crackpots. But since my youth, I've begun to realize that it's not just the crackpots that see UFOs. After all, we have such rather notable people as Thutmose III, Pharaoh of Egypt, the explorer Christopher Columbus, who had a couple of sightings on his voyage over to America, the American president Andrew Jackson, the Ohio governor John Gilligan, two astronauts James McDivitt and Gordon Cooper, and these were reported live on TV if you were around in the early 70s, and then Jimmy Carter, who personally saw two UFO sightings. So, all different kinds of people see UFOs. Astronomers see UFOs. I have some of my colleagues up in Canada who submitted reports of UFOs. People who are very knowledgeable about the skies, astronauts, astronomers, people who have credibility like Andrew Jackson, Christopher Columbus, and you go all the way back in the times of the Greeks and the Romans. Almost every Roman historian recorded UFO events, and then Thutmose III, who personally saw one such event. And therefore, we can state with respect to UFOs, there's no new thing under the sun, and the same kinds of phenomena that are being observed today have been observed in the past. Maxim number two, seeing is not believing. Just because you see something that looks like a UFO may not mean that it's actually real. And give you an example of what I mean by seeing is not believing. Consider this device. This is a device that our radio astronomers in Ottawa, Canada, submitted to the machine shop for construction. We asked for 1,000 such three-prong widgets from the machinists in our lab. Needless to say, push it up a little. How's that? Three-pronged widget. And as you look at that little diagram, you can understand the consternation that the machinists had trying to put out 1,000 of these widgets. But the same kind of illusion that you're seeing here is very common with UFOs. And just because we see something doesn't mean that what we're seeing is really what's up there. And here's maxim number three. We all recognize that the eye can be deceived, that the ear can be deceived, but what about instrumentation? Well, any scientist who has dealt with instrumentation can tell you that instruments aren't a whole lot better than the human senses. They can be deceived, sometimes they can be deceived even more effectively than our human senses. It's just that we can record a deception a little more carefully than we can experience it through our senses. What I want to show you now, if I can have the lights, is a couple of slides. I got somebody handling the lights, I think. So, a couple of slides that I took on our vacation, actually. Kathy wonders why I took so many slides on our vacation, but it was quite difficult to photograph some UFOs. Right about there, you can see a UFO that we photographed this summer. There's my wife, Kathy. But there's the UFO. And looks rather incredible sitting up there in the skies. And I had to wait for just the right kind of mist. There's a very rare, very fine kind of mist. In fact, you couldn't even notice that there was a mist in the area. It just seemed like a cloudy day. Well, the right diameter for the water droplets, the camera can photograph the clouds and pick up interesting little patterns due to the tricks of the optics and the weather at that time. This is a much more common kind of UFO photograph. Now, this isn't too good. I could have done a little bit better. But as you can see, there's a cluster of UFOs right here, and another cluster of UFOs right there. Now this was taken inside a restaurant over Lake Louise, and the shot was taken through glass, and of course we're picking up the reflections of the chandeliers. Sneaky, eh? Instruments can deceive. Now, the kinds of photographs that I've just showed you are what would be called honest deceptions. You know, somebody could take photographs like that, and some are much more clever than the ones that I've taken. And not knowing your instrument, you can think you've really recorded something spectacular. And unless you know the instrument very well, you may not recognize there's false imaging that's going on. Now, in addition to this, there are those sets of photographs that are purposely designed to deceive. One of the most difficult hoaxes to crack is a photograph of a model of a UFO or a flying saucer that's suspended by a fishing line that you can hardly see, and then you put the camera very slightly out of focus and drop back about 30 feet and have the right backdrop. Sometimes they paint the backdrop. Other times use a natural backdrop. But in each case, you get the impression of a craft several hundred feet across, moving across the sky. Instruments can deceive. And number four is very closely tied in with number three, beware of the printed word. Getting a collection of newspaper clippings and trying to learn something about UFOs is really quite ridiculous. We must remember that newspapers are written to sell. And there's someone that's purposely set up a hoax of a UFO, taken a spectacular-looking photograph, and they submit that to the newspaper, chances are it'll get frontline or front-page billing. Now, when the hoax is exposed 10 years later, it'll be on page 52 with about four lines of type, if at all. And this is very common with respect to UFOs and very common with respect to certain newspapers, which I won't name, which tend to specialize in UFO reporting. Those newspapers, which I won't name, their UFO reporting is about 99.9% fallacious. They're reporting something that isn't even a true UFO. Rather, it's a hoax, or it's a set of IFOs, or they're talking to observers who really aren't too sure of what they're seeing. And number five, again, is closely related to four, records are never complete. And when you're trying to, we really were frustrated with this in talking with people who'd seen unidentified flying objects. You'd ask them where in the sky it was, and they'll say, well, it was about like so. And it's pretty hard to pin down what kind of object was up there. The observers have a great difficulty giving you complete records. And even where the records themselves are complete, the sum total of the records might not be complete. You may have observations from one site and not observations from a second site. And you need multiply sighted observations in order to determine what kind of object you're looking at. If you just have observations from one site, you really can't tell very much at all. You cannot distinguish between a real object and an image with just sightings from one site. You need sightings from a minimum of five or six different locations before you can determine by triangulation whether or not the object is real. Number six, and as an astronomer, we ran into this quite often. Men make mysterious machines. And let me just share one incident that happened at our radio telescope in northern Ontario, out in the boondocks in the middle of a wildlife reserve. But it was also within 60 miles of the North American Air Defense Command. And they do have some interesting craft. And we would see these craft hovering over our telescope. I suspect that the pilots were rather curious as to what kind of instrument we were fooling around with, and we were equally curious as to what kind of instruments they were fooling around with. The problem was that those instruments would interfere with our observations. And so we would call up NORAD headquarters, North American Air Defense, call them up on the phone and say, could you please instruct your pilots to move away from our telescope so we can proceed with our observations? And they would respond by saying, what craft? It has nothing to do with us. And they would not own up to the fact that this kind of thing was going on. They would totally deny it. They totally denied it, that is, until we started phoning in the sightings of these craft to the Ottawa newspapers. And then they would go from Ottawa across the country about these strange-looking craft. And we'd try to describe these craft in some detail. Once we started tipping off the newspapers, they stopped flying over our telescope. We had no more trouble with these mysterious machines. But there are plenty of machines that our air forces are building that can cause us some disturbance as we see them flying around. And Peter Millman again quoted from the Bible for maxim number 7, do you know the laws of the heavens? Again quoting from Ecclesiastes, King Solomon, do you know the laws of the heavens? And one thing about physicists, there's a pride that they have that's shared by other scientists, and they think that they can explain everything with the laws of physics. And that's just not true. Now, there's many things that are outside the explanation of the laws of physics. However, the man in the street has picked up this pride from the scientists, and they also have the impression that the laws of physics are adequate to explain everything. And what does God tell us? Do you know the laws of the heavens? And the answer is rhetorical, no. He's the only one that knows all the laws of the heavens. Now, number 8 here will lead us into some insights as to what UFOs are really all about. Maxim number 8. There are no artifacts, no proven cases of physical contact with UFOs. In other words, we are lacking in physical evidence of flying saucers and unidentified flying objects. By artifacts, I mean debris, like crash debris, or parts left behind, something tangible that you can touch and pick up that's come from a UFO or is part of a UFO. No such artifacts. Now, with 700,000 plus sightings and 800 encounters of the second kind and 1,000 encounters of the third kind, it's really statistically unrealistic not to expect some artifacts or crash debris. But let me quickly review for you the evidence of the non-physical nature of unidentified flying objects. Number 1, at the same sighting, a UFO can be seen but not photographed, or photographed but not seen. In other words, you can see the UFO up in the sky, and then you try to take a picture of it, there's no image on the photographic film. Or you see nothing out there, and you take a picture, and it shows up on the photographic film. Real objects don't behave that way. Physical objects don't behave that way. If you can see them, you can photograph them. And if you can photograph them, you usually can see them. Number 2 is like number 1. At the same sighting, a UFO can be detected and tracked by radar, but not seen, or seen but not detected by radar. In other words, you can be tracking it on a radar scope, and nobody can see it. Or everybody can see it, and you try to look for it on radar, it doesn't show up. Again, that's not the behavior of physical objects. And number 3, never, not once, has there ever been a sonic boom from a UFO, even though UFOs typically travel at thousands of miles per hour. And anything that goes at greater than 700 miles per hour should cause a rather dramatic sonic boom. We do not hear or experience sonic booms from UFOs. Not one recorded case, even though there are hundreds of thousands of events where the image appeared to go at thousands or even tens of thousands of miles per hour. Number 4, some UFOs project light beams of finite length. And this is interesting because light does not restrict itself to finite length. It may gradually disperse itself like a flashlight. If you shine a flashlight, the light will eventually disperse into nothing. But if you've got a really strong flashlight and you only get a 5-foot long beam of light out of it, that's something that's non-physical. Light does not behave that way normally. So this is something that's abnormal. Number 5 is like number 3. Frequently, UFOs are reported to violate the laws of physics. For example, making a sharp right-angle turn at 18,000 miles per hour. Now, you know what it's like to make a sharp turn in a car. Now, you can feel it. If you make a sharp enough turn at a high enough velocity, it'll shatter the molecules in your body and you'll be splatted against the windshield, side window, whatever. But at 18,000 miles per hour, a sharp right angle turn, even a solid ball of steel would be smashed. So even if the object were solid steel, it would not withstand this sharp right angle turn at that velocity. This is just one of many examples of the violation of the laws of physics. Number six, UFOs change shape, size, and color at random. You can be watching a UFO and the colors constantly change. You can be watching a UFO and it goes from circular to rectangular to ellipsoidal. The size can be very small and then starts to grow in front of you, then it shrinks back down. Real objects don't tend to do that. You know, real objects have some limited capacity to do that, but not to the extent of UFOs. Number seven, at the same sighting, a UFO may disappear and reappear or disintegrate and integrate. What I mean by disintegrate and integrate, you can see one object. Then you can see, say, seven little objects coming out of the one big object, or the big object splitting into four objects, and they all do their little tricks. And then a few minutes later, the four objects come back together and form one object, or form two objects, or whatever. That's what I mean by disintegration and integration. And people have thought of it being a mother flying saucer, putting out little small explorer flying saucers. But the degree of integration and disintegration is beyond that kind of simplistic explanation. That's not sufficient. Then they just simply disappear. Then they reappear at another time. Number eight, no UFO communication or control signals have ever been intercepted. Now, if these objects are real, and given the quantity of these objects, they should be communicating with one another. In fact, the antics that they perform in the skies are such that if they didn't communicate with one another, they'd be in real trouble. But we never pick up any communications. Nothing is ever intercepted. Number nine, there is no uniformity to UFOs. By that I mean every UFO you see is different from any other UFO that's been seen. They're all different. They're not the same. And given the economics of making real objects, you'd have to use some kind of assembly line procedure just to save money, if nothing else. But they're all different. Each one is individual compared to the other. Number 10, never has a UFO artifact or any UFO crash debris been recovered. Nothing real anybody can look at in a museum. No high-resolution photographic images of UFOs have been obtained. The images all lack in their degree of sharpness. They're all fuzzy to some extent, some very fuzzy. And at the same sighting, the resolution of a UFO image may change. Can't see that one? How's that? In other words, the image can be reasonably sharp, then it gets very blurry. And then it goes from very blurry to reasonably sharp again. It's like the thing going in and out of focus. Very disturbing. Real objects don't do that. And 13, UFO-related electromagnetic phenomena are out of all proportion to the electromagnetic forces observed. That's a mouthful. Let me give you some examples of that. A car can be running along, and a UFO can be sighted just above the car, and then the car is suddenly locked. The motor is running and the motor stops running, and you discover that there's some powerful magnetic field was there that grabbed hold of the metal parts and froze them to one another. And you can calculate the amount of magnetic field that you would need, and it's something like 40 to 50,000 gauss. And yet instruments that were measuring the magnetic field in the area at the time record something on the order of one gauss. Okay? Real objects don't do that. So this is something that's non-physical. Everything that we know about UFOs demonstrates its non-physical character. Now, number nine. And number nine goes with number eight in showing that UFOs and flying saucers are not visitors from outer space, like us, human in form, and real kinds of spacecraft coming to visit us or spy on us. The possibility of life originating on its own is absurdly remote. And what I want to do is to share with you a couple of U-graphs I have to demonstrate that as far as intelligent life is concerned in the universe, we'd be wise to stop looking. We're really just about it. Now let me share with you why I think that is so. This has been published, this data has been published in the last 2 years in Science Magazine as well as other places. And astronomers 15, 20 years ago used to talk about life being very common in the universe, and even intelligent life being rather common in the universe. And they would argue along these lines. We know that there are trillions of planets in the universe, and with so many planets in the universe, the probability of finding another planet like planet Earth is rather high, and therefore there must be many like-sited planets within the universe, and surely one of those would have evolved life like our own. Well, now that has been disproven by careful analysis of the planet Earth and our star, the Sun. And what these parameters show is just how little the characteristics of the Earth and the Sun need to be changed to destroy the possibility of planet Earth supporting life for anything like a million years. If the surface gravity of planet Earth were changed by 1/1000th, either larger or smaller, life on planet Earth would not be possible. Okay, change it by 0.1%, life on planet Earth is not possible. If you were to change the rotation period by 0.1%, say from 24 hours to something like 20 hours, you'd run into the same problem. Distance from the star, this is very sensitive. If we were to change the distance from Earth to the Sun by a million miles closer or farther away, life as we know it on planet Earth would not be possible. The albedo, that's the reflectivity of the Earth's surface, inclination of the equator, this would be the inclination of the Earth to the equator of the Sun, the magnetic field of the Earth and the magnetic field of the Sun, the eccentricity or the skewness of the orbit of the Earth about the Sun, the density of the planet, and the atmospheric temperature gradient, how quickly the temperature falls off from the surface out through the outer layers of the Earth's atmosphere, and the transparency of the Earth's atmosphere. Now we get into the star. Our star, the Sun, is rather unique. Only one type of star can evolve planets. The age of the star must be very carefully fixed, and very sensitive is the mass of the star. If you were to change the mass of the star by 2 parts in 10,000, then that star would not be able to produce a planet like the Earth where life could be supported. The location of the star in the galaxy is very sensitive, and the number of stars in the star system. Most stars occur with other stars nearby. Our Sun is interesting in that it is alone. And then here's a catch-all factor, the longevity of the parameters. Some stars and planets would have the right parameters, but they wouldn't last for a sufficiently long period of time for life to develop on that planet. And if we put all of these probabilities together, we discover that the chance that all these 16 parameters would be correct for the support of life is 1 chance in 2 to 10 to the minus 30. The number 2 divided by 1 with 30 zeros after it. Now, you know, people argue, but the universe is very large. And the universe is very large. Astronomers have seen the edge of the universe. And there are 10 trillion galaxies in our universe. And every galaxy has about 100 billion stars. And about half of those stars have about 10 planets apiece. So you add up all the planets in the universe, and you find there's 10 to the 25 planets. That's a trillion times 10 planets. However, the probability of life forming on any one of those planets anywhere in the universe is only 2 chances times 10 to the minus 30. To translate that for you, there's less than 1 chance in 500,000 that any planet anywhere in our universe would have the parameters that are necessary for the support of life. So when people talk about there being many planets in the universe that have life on them, they're talking nonsense. There's only 1 chance in 500,000 that we're even here. You know, the planet Earth is able to support life, let alone there being another planet. Now, what about life? We're just talking about the conditions being right for the support of life. What about the development of life on that planet? And here we'll be talking about Darwinian evolution. This is the idea that you have the right mix of chemicals, that if you just wait long enough, those chemicals will come together and form protein molecules that will come together and form simple life forms that will eventually come together and form human beings. Well, I'm not going to go into the human being thing. Let's just look at the simplest possible life form, which is a very primitive virus. And by computer analysis, scientists have determined that the simplest living thing is a virus composed of 239 protein molecules. There's nothing any simpler than that that's possible that can reproduce. Now, a virus cannot live by itself. A virus is a parasite, so without other life there, it can't even survive. But for purposes of argument, let's just take the simplest possible living thing. It would be comprised of 239 protein molecules. Each protein molecule would contain about 445 amino acids, and each slot in the protein molecule chain must be filled by one of 20 different amino acids. Now, if you've got a pocket calculator, you can determine the chance of random assembly. That chance of random assembly is 1 and the number of different amino acids that exist, 20, taken to the power of the number of amino acids in each protein molecule, which is 445, and you must multiply that power by the number of different protein molecules in the system, which is 239, and you have to divide that whole number by 239 factorial. That's a shorthand notation for 239 times 238 times 237 times 236 and so on to 3 times 2 times 1. Now, if you've got an expensive enough pocket calculator, you can convert that into decimal notation. Rather than working in powers of 20, you can work in powers of 10, and it roughly works out to 1 chance in 10 to the 137,000 915. That's the number 1 with 137,915 zeros after it. However, this is not quite a living thing yet. Each amino acid must first be activated by a special enzyme. Also, multiple special enzymes are needed to bind the RNA molecules to the ribosomes. Those are the building sites within the nucleus of these living things. And lastly, only amino acids with left-hand configurations can be used. Now, maybe you didn't know this, but amino acids come in two types. There are those types that have their hydrogen atom on the left-hand side, and there are those types that have their hydrogen atom on the right-hand side. And in the real world, they occur 50-50. There's a 50-50 chance that an amino acid will be right-handed. But you get one right-handed amino acid anywhere in the system, and it's not going to reproduce. It's not going to work. You can only use left-handed ones. Now, you put these factors into the equation for the chance of random assembly, and you discover that the chance of random assembly is 1 in 10 to the 15 billion. Now, to give you a handle on that number, you can take a Bible, a complete Bible, Old and New Testament, take the type that's written out there, write down the number 1, and fill up that Bible with zeros. You'll need 3,000 Bibles to write out this number, and one chance in 10 of the 15 billion. To give you an idea of what 3,000 Bibles would look like, you could fill in the gaps in the transept here from the floor to the top with those Bibles. That's how big that number is. Now, people have typically argued this way. We know that life is improbable, that the possibility of life assembling itself is rather remote. However, we also recognize that the universe is very large and very old. And surely, since the universe is so old and so large, there must be a possibility even for this kind of remote possibility to take place. Well, we can compare that number with the age of the universe and the size of the universe. The universe is about 18 billion years old, give or take a couple of billion. astronomers are still arguing about the couples of billions, and that translates roughly into 10 to the 18 seconds. And you can take the whole size of the universe. I told you there's a trillion times a trillion stars and 10 trillion times a trillion planets. Take all the planets, all the stars, all the gas, all the dust, all the X-rays, everything, all the material in the universe, and convert it into fundamental particles, and you wind up with 10 of the 80th. Or you can convert it into amino acids. You would get 10 of the 76th amino acids. Convert the entire physical universe into amino acids, and you get 10 of the 76. Now design the ideal experiment. Take the whole universe, convert it into amino acids, and slot those amino acids into protein molecule slots for the entire age of the universe. What is the probability, working at one slot per second, that you would get the simplest possible living thing out at the end? That would be one chance in 10 of the 15 billion minus 76 in the index minus 18 in the index. Or one chance in 10 of the 14 billion 999,999,906. You're not even denting this figure. It's still a phenomenally large number. You still need 3,000 Bibles to write that number out. You've only eliminated 94 zeros. You got quite a few more to go. In other words, the universe is ridiculously too small and ridiculously too young to even consider the possibility of chance assembly of life. So really we must concede that the only reason why there's life on planet Earth is because of some set of divine miracles. And astronomers and biochemists the world over have conceded that fact within the last few years. Now, all of my colleagues in astronomy have conceded the fact that the universe has been created by some kind of divine being outside of space and time. And the biochemists are coming to the same conclusion about the formation of life. It takes a set of miracles to explain life. Now, where was I on the UFO maxims? Here's 10. Some UFO phenomena are spiritual in nature. They're not physical. If something is not physical and it's still real, and we have plenty of evidence that UFOs are real, if they're real and not physical, they must be spiritual. Now, I'd like to suggest a spiritual explanation for UFOs. And that is their relationship with demonic phenomena. And by demonic phenomena, I'm referring to fallen angels. The Bible gives us abundance data on angels, both good and evil. And if we compare the range of phenomena for UFOs and flying saucers, we discover that they're identical with the range of phenomena that we experience with demons and fallen angels. Let me give you some examples. And this is very interesting in terms of my colleagues, because most of my colleagues a few decades ago wouldn't even concede the possibility of anything this strange. They would try to explain everything that they observe within the physical realm only. But because of the incidence of UFOs and of also the occult, it's interesting, the physics department at Caltech is now heavy into the occult, the study of demonic phenomena, because they think they can find new laws of physics by trying to find out where all that missing magnetism went. You know, 50,000 Gauss being explained by one Gauss, they say, hey, that looks like cheap energy. You can get 50,000 Gauss from one Gauss. We want to find out how. And so they're deeply involved in occultic research at this time, and this includes UFO phenomena. Now, let's look at this evidence. One, UFO messages are identical to the messages received by mediums and mystics and witches. Specifically, they condone racism, anti-Semitism, illegal sex, drug abuse, astrology, occultism, anything else to do with the evil underworld. They deny the deity of Jesus Christ, the existence of hell, God's judgment, salvation by grace through faith in Christ. In other words, they deny the fundamental tenets of Christianity, and they have this in common with demons. It includes scientific and historical errors in abundance and also contradictions. These beings on UFOs will tell people such things that the sun is not hot and that Pluto is not cold and there's life on the other side of the moon. They also predicted that men would never land on the moon. In each case, they were proven wrong. Even things like the diameter of the Earth and the mass of the Earth, they claimed that the diameter of the Earth was 10 times smaller than it actually is. So rather ridiculous scientific and historical errors in quite a degree of abundance. And where one being on a UFO would contradict the data from another being on a UFO. Murder is very common. Rape is very common when beings from UFOs engage with human beings. Books dictated by UFOnauts have content that is identical to the content of books produced through automatic writing. What I mean by automatic writing is when an individual goes into a trance and a demon begins to work through that individual in a trance, and as the individual is sleeping or in his trance-like state, he dictates a book, and then people write it down. Edgar Casey is a prime example of that. Volumes of books were written while Edgar Casey dictated them in his sleep. And the same kind of phenomena takes place when people have contact with beings from these flying saucers and UFOs. UFOnauts frequently are reported to have driven cars with unregistered license plates. What I mean by this is they come out of their UFO craft and they go into a car and they start driving this car around. And then the police start chasing these outer space beings, so-called outer space beings, in their automobiles. And they see the license plate, they write it down, check in their records, no such license plate. And the same kind of thing takes place with demonic phenomena. Demons will drive cars that have non-existing license plates. Both UFO and demonic phenomena are much more frequent where light is dim or where there is darkness. UFOnauts preach the occult gospel. What is the occult gospel? We have within ourselves the power to achieve perfection without Christ. In other words, you can receive salvation, you can receive blessings from God without having to go through Jesus Christ. The Bible tells us, Jesus quoted it himself, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by me. Demons and UFOnauts agree in denying that basic doctrine. They're trying to convince people on this planet that they can achieve perfection through means other than Jesus Christ. UFO contactees experience voices in the mind. Let me just quickly run through these. Both UFOs and demons dazzle men with displays of miraculous power. Both UFOnauts and mediums predict the future spectacularly, but inconsistently, that is, incorrectly. Nauseous odors often accompany UFO events. UFOs and UFOnauts urge men to enter biblically forbidden areas of knowledge and experience. UFOnauts are obsessed with distorting biblical theology. 14, abnormally high death, suicide, and insanity rates are experienced among UFO contactees and researchers. And some of my fellow astronomers have had some very unpleasant experiences through delving too deeply into UFO research. UFO contactees are occasionally killed by having their flesh fall off their bones while they're still standing. They're talking to you, and they're standing, they're walking around, the flesh is falling off their bones. Demons can do that, UFOnauts can do that too. UFOnauts are often featureless. They may be walking around in a business suit, but they have just a blurry face, or just a ball of light where their face is supposed to be. UFO and demonic experiences seem to occur exclusively among those individuals who have opened the door to the occult. And that's one thing I've personally noted over 12 years of investigating UFO sightings. The people that see UFOs, the people that have contact with UFO beings, they have one thing in common. Every one of them has opened the door to the occult in some way. Ouija boards, astrology, praying for supernatural powers, that kind of thing. And lastly, the demonic theory for UFOs is the only exception to Guerin's Law. And what is Guerin's Law? In UFOlogy, any law is immediately violated by subsequent sightings, which means you cannot make any law about UFOs, because the next few sightings will prove those laws wrong. One exception to that is the demonic theory. The demonic theory has never been proven wrong by any sighting of a UFO. Now, one thing about UFO sightings, they're on the increase, or at least they were. There's no new thing under the sun, our first UFO maxim. And you can see a little red line here at the bottom. And as you go back all the way 6, 7, 8,000 years, as you check the historical records, you'll find that there was an abundance of UFO sightings. Several per year, every year consistently throughout human history. And that number of several per year, per million people, did not change much up until this century. It was constant, about one-tenth of a sighting per year, per million people. It should work out to at least several or dozens for the whole population. But around about 1935, 1940, that began to increase for the first time. And then in 1966 and 67, it jumped by over a factor of 100. And now it's starting to level off at about 12 sightings per year per million people. A very dramatic increase in the number of UFO sightings. I want to read to you one scripture passage I think relates to UFOs in closing. Many people quote various passages of the Bible with respect to UFOs, usually incorrectly, but let me look at one passage, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is prophecy. It's talking about an event to take place in the future, namely that a dictator will arise on the earth who will gain political and economic control of the entire world. And 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 gives us some insight as to when we can expect this to take place. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day, the day of the Lord's coming, will not take place until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness, that's that dictator, is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He opposes and exalts himself over everything that is called God or is worshiped, and even sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. And in the book of Daniel, we are told that that event will take place where this dictator declares himself to be God about 3.5 years before the second coming of Jesus Christ. Don't you remember that when I was with you, I used to tell you these things? And now you know what is holding him back so that he may be revealed at the proper time. For the secret power of lawlessness is already at work, but the one who now holds it back will continue to do so until he is taken out of the way. And most biblical theologians interpret this as a taking away of Christians. Many passages in the Bible talk about Jesus Christ coming to the earth in the sky and taking bodily all the dead and living Christians away from the planet up to the kingdom of heaven. Now, following this event, verse 8, and then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy by the splendor of his coming. The coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing. They perish because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so that they will believe the lie, and so that all will be condemned who have not believed and accepted the truth, but have delighted in wickedness. I think there's a reason why UFO sightings have gone up so dramatically. There's also a reason why we had so many films like The Body Snatchers. You know, theories that flying saucers will come to the Earth and take a couple of 100 million hostages away. When Jesus Christ comes and takes away all the people away from this planet, Satan's going to have to come up with an explanation for those that are left behind. And I'm just, I can't even think of the word right now, speculating at this point, but my speculation is that Satan will try to explain the disappearance of a few 100 million Christians by saying UFOs have come, beings from outer space have come, they've attacked our planet, and they have taken hostages. And people will believe the lie. Satan's going to come up with a lie, and people are going to believe it. We've heard a lot of evidence tonight. Evidence that life is impossible on other planets. Life even on our planet's impossible without a set of miracles. We've seen evidence about the supernatural, things that exist beyond the laws of physics. All of these things are in line with the Bible. The Bible tells us that God created the universe, that he created Earth for the support of life, and he created life on the Earth. He's also told us about angels and demons, and he has warned us that demons will try to deceive people. And we see a growing deception taking place today. This evening we have received evidence, knowledge. And God expects us to act on the knowledge that we have received. And he's looking for a commitment to obey his son Jesus Christ. And he has promised that anyone who commits his life to the control of Jesus Christ, where that commitment is based on sound knowledge, proof that these things that I'm saying are true, then that man can have a relationship with Jesus Christ. And I was going to leave some time for questions. It's late. I'll be available for questions afterwards. Feel free to come up, and I'll stay here as long as you want to stay. We have materials on a table here and a table out at the back, and you're welcome to pick up materials. I'll explain what I've been talking about in some further detail. But let me close in a brief word of prayer. Father, we thank you for the evidence that you've given us tonight of a supernatural invasion of this planet. And Lord, I pray we would be motivated to read your book, the Bible, to discover more about the invasion that we're experiencing right now and the invasion that is yet to come. And we thank you too, Lord, for the evidence that we receive through science and through history for the truth of creation. For the truth of our existence here, for the truth of things beyond the laws of physics, for your existence. Lord, we thank you for giving us proof that we can be assured that these things that are in your book, the Bible, really are true. And I pray, Father, that you would move our hearts to bend our knee, bow down before you, and give up the control of our life, to stop running our lives our way and to allow you to take control. And Father, I pray as you do take control that you would use us for your glory and for your service, and you would fill us with your Holy Spirit that we may express your love, joy, and peace to others around us. And we thank you for this. In Jesus' name, amen.
This is the end of side two and of this cassette. If you would like more information or more messages by Dr. Ross, just write to the address on the back of this tape and request them. Thank you very much.